Hello. It's January 9th, 2025. My name is Simone, and this is the season 6 premiere of 90s Crime Time. Hello and welcome to the season 6 premiere of 90s Crime Time. And if you're new to 90s Crime Time, welcome to the show. I hope you all have had a great week so far and are preparing for a good weekend. And we are back. I promised you all I would be back soon with season 6 of 90s Crime Time. And here we are, and I'm very excited. On season 6, if you haven't listened to the promo released last Thursday, the season will feature crimes of mystery, murders, mayhem, and everything else you can imagine. However, I'll go ahead and say I do not do 90s Crime Time for pure entertainment because these stories have victims and they have families more than likely, so I bring these cases to you simply for awareness of what crazy crimes occurred during this decade and that evil can walk among us. With that said, today's season premiere focuses on an intriguing case involving an unsolved murder and a missing person case, which reports suggest may be connected. However, all the potential suspects featured in this episode have not been charged with any crimes, so any scenario naming a potential suspect is purely alleged. Now, let's dive in to today's season 6 premiere. The year was 1999, and in the quaint New England town of Scarborough, Maine, it was one of the oldest incorporated towns in U.S. history, being incorporated in the year 1658. Around the 1990s, though, Scarborough had a population of around 12,000 residents, and from all accounts, the residents seemed pretty close-knit. Scarborough, according to officials and residents alike, quote-unquote, was seen as a premier community for families and businesses and a destination for outdoor enthusiasts. Even better, to some Scarborough natives, despite being just a short distance from the bustling capital city of Portland, Scarborough offered a small-town vibe where they and their families could feel safe. However, in the winter of 1999, residents of Scarborough were horrified when news broke that a young girl's battered body was found on a local road. And it would leave many in Scarborough scared and wondering if the case would ever be solved. In the following case, you'll find out who the young lady was, the investigation, and the shocking aftermath. In a case I title, A Chilling Connection. In the early morning hours of February 10, 1999, at around 4 a.m., a motorist named Michael Lopez and his mother were driving home on Pine Point Road in Scarborough, Maine. As they were on their journey, they came across a peculiar sight. It looked as if a body was on the road. As they inched closer, they realized that there was indeed a body on the road, and Michael got out of his vehicle to investigate. When he got close to the body, Michael saw it was a young-looking girl, possibly a teenager, and she was face down on the pavement, lined up on the center lines. The girl was wearing two lightweight shirts, black leggings, and platform shoes, but no coat, which was very odd due to the fact it was freezing cold temperatures that night. Also, Michael noticed the young woman looked like she was placed on the road, especially since her hands were by her sides, her legs were out straight, her hair was combed, and her clothes were buttoned like she was propped. Lastly, Michael noticed that although she appeared dead, as she had no pulse, but her body was still warm. And curiously, her skin was blue, and she had a small amount of dried blood around her nose and mouth. Michael called 911 from his cell phone and attempted CPR on the victim while waiting for emergency personnel. When they arrived, they interviewed Michael and his mother, but quickly shifted their focus to the young girl. Upon further examination, they declared the victim dead at the scene and theorized that due to marks around her neck, she had been strangled. After the initial examination, the body was removed from the street, and while waiting for the victim's autopsy to be complete, they had to figure out who the victim was. Reports state the victim had no ID on her body, so police had to use other resources, such as checking for missing persons reports, to check if the victim matched any of the reports. They also checked local schools for girls who might be absent and talked to people in the neighborhood to see if they knew about a young, possibly teenage girl who was missing. But they came up with nothing. So police then reached out to local TV stations, and when they broadcasted a description of the body on the 12 o'clock news, tips started to come in like wildfire. And many of the tips suggested the murdered young woman was 15-year-old Ashley Ouellette. However, police couldn't confirm the identity of the victim until around 2 p.m. later that day, when a couple named Robert and Lisa Ouellette went to the Scarborough police station and inquired about the young woman found dead after they received word that it might have been their daughter, Ashley. And after they were shown a crime scene photo, they confirmed the heartbreaking news that the victim was indeed their daughter, 15-year-old Ashley Ouellette. According to reports, Ashley Erin Ouellette was born on March 29, 1983, in Saco, Maine, to Robert and Lisa Ouellette, where she was also raised. Ashley was raised in a fairly privileged household, and when she started her education, her parents enrolled her in the prestigious local private school, Thornton Academy. Here at Thornton, Ashley was well known for being a straight-A student, being very social, and being very popular. As she grew older, things for Ashley continued to go well until around her middle school years. You see, reports state that around this time, as many preteens and teens do, Ashley began to experiment and rebel, meaning she started to hang around some people around town and at school who drank and smoked, and she wanted to try it out. When she did, though, Ashley almost made it a habit every time she hung out with some particular friends to smoke and drink. And once it became to be too much and her parents found out, Ashley was said to argue with them constantly about her rebellious stage. Her parents were even more worried about her behavior when her grades began to fall and she would stay out too late. So in return, they enrolled Ashley into an alternative program at Thornton, placed her in counseling, and grounded her indefinitely. After this, reports state Ashley still hung around the same crowd, but made sure to only do so when her parents weren't around. However, as her time at Thornton went by, her grades did get better, she acted nicer around her parents, and due to this, her parents sort of eased up on her punishment phase. By her sophomore year in 1999, Ashley was still in the alternative program in counseling, but her parents thought they saw a change in her behavior, especially during her second semester, and by this time, they put more trust in Ashley. So much so, that on the night of February 9th, 1999, after Ashley asked if she could attend an all-girls sleepover at her friend Aaliyah Page's home, which was a mile away, her parents reluctantly agreed. Her parents felt even better when Ashley said she would go to school with Aaliyah the next morning. After Ashley left for the sleepover, her mom Lisa was worried about what Ashley might get into, especially given her past. But when Ashley called her around 10 p.m. and she heard girls laughing in the background, Lisa began to relax. Reports state that during the phone call, Ashley told her mother that she and her friends were doing each other's nails. And right before the call ended, Ashley told Lisa that she loved her, and then they hung up. However, what Lisa and Ashley's father Robert didn't know was that Ashley's friend Aaliyah's parents weren't home, which meant there was no supervision, and Aaliyah used this factor to make her quote-unquote all-girls sleepover into a co-ed party. As the party went on into the early morning hours of February 10th, Ashley decided she was done with the party. But instead of going to sleep or heading back to her home, she asked a friend named Jason Carney, who most people called Jay, who was at the party, to take her somewhere. She told Jay that she needed a ride to her aunt's house to babysit. But when she got in Jay's car, she told him she actually wanted a ride to her ex-boyfriend, Stephen Sanborn's home. Stephen was 18 at the time and lived with his parents and younger brother Daniel, who was also at the party. When Jay and Ashley got to the Sanborn home, located deep into a heavily remote and wooded area, off the very long road of Mast Hill Road in Saco, Ashley got out and knocked on the door, but there was no answer. Ashley then got back in the car, and Jay took her to a gas station to use a payphone. Reports state Ashley called the Sanborn home and spoke with Sanborn's family friend, 18-year-old Christopher Cote, who lived with the family. She told Christopher she was trying to meet up with Stephen and asked him if he was there. Christopher apparently told her he was, and Ashley said she wanted to talk to him. When Christopher reportedly told Stephen that Ashley was on the phone, Stephen refused to talk to her, and then Christopher hung up. However, Ashley allegedly kept calling the home, but she kept getting ignored. So she asked Jay to take her back to the Sanborn home. When the two got back a little after midnight, she got out and Jay left, apparently. Ashley then knocked on the back door of the home, which was near the Sanborn brothers' bedrooms, and according to reports, after no one answered, Ashley made her way into the home through the basement and ran into Daniel, who was getting ready for bed, and his mother Muriel in the hallway. According to reports, after police found out during the investigation that later on Ashley went by the home, when questioning the Sanborns, Muriel told police Ashley told her and Daniel that she had fought with her parents and that they had kicked her out of the house. Muriel said she believed her and told her she could stay the night in the basement on the couch outside of her son's rooms. She added that around 12:45 a.m., she saw Ashley on the couch, and Daniel gave her something to drink because she said she was hot. Then she said that when she woke up around 6:45 a.m., Ashley was no longer in the house. Daniel told police that he did get Ashley something to drink and then went to bed. He added that later that morning, as he left for school, he didn't see Ashley in the home either. However, when detectives checked his alibi from Thornton Academy, they noted Daniel was marked absent. When confronting him about this, Daniel changed his story and said he actually slept in that morning, skipped school, and spent the afternoon with friends. Although they were skeptical about his story, detectives then questioned Stephen. Reports state Stephen told detectives he was asleep when she arrived, that he assumed Ashley spent the night in Dan's room because he said Ashley was a friend of his, and that when Daniel's friends came over, they'd usually sleep in his room. He also said that when he got up, he didn't see Ashley in the home. He said when he got to Thornton, he'd heard there was a deceased girl found on a road the previous night and that it might have been Ashley. He also told detectives that he and Ashley had a brief sexual relationship between 1996 and 1997, even though Ashley was Daniel's friend, was around 13 years old, and Stephen was way in his teenage years. Then reports state, detectives stopped questioning Stephen. But they then questioned Christopher, and he said he was asleep when Ashley got to the home and didn't see her either when he woke up. Now, detectives wanted to focus more of their attention on Daniel, since his story was proven false by the school. As a matter of fact, before they even questioned anyone in the home, detectives noticed a 1991 Eagle Summit car, and a detective glanced inside, and they noticed some brown, dry grass on the floorboard. They didn't think too much of it until the results of Ashley's autopsy came back, and it read that not only had she been confirmed strangled to death, but she also had evidence on her to suggest some sort of sexual activity occurred with her, and strands of grass were found in Ashley's hair. And when a search warrant was eventually signed to search the Sanborns' home for clues, when detectives searched the Eagle Summit, they learned it was Daniel's car, and concluded the grass found in the car matched the grass found on Ashley. Also inside the car, they found a black blouse, fingernail particles, a scarf, and hair. Inside the home, detectives discovered a trail of blood droplets on the floor between the kitchen and living room, which they swabbed and sent to a crime lab for analysis. They also gathered other items from the home for evidence, including but not limited to carpet, upholstery items, a purple cord, linens, a stained pillow, and an open condom wrapper. With another report stating detectives found, quote-unquote, other signs of sexual activity as well. After gathering the evidence and waiting for the lab results to come back, detectives moved their focus to Ashley's parents, who suggested there was no way Ashley would have tried to leave the Sanborn home to try and possibly go back home or back to Aaliyah's home without a ride, since the home was so remote and was at least 10 miles away from their home. They said she would have more than likely called a family member to pick her up. They were also adamant that Ashley would not have left the home without a coat due to the temperature. After questioning the Ouellettes and still waiting for lab results to return, detectives still wanted to figure out what happened with Ashley between the time Mrs. Sanborn said she saw her at around 12:45 a.m. and when her body was found around 4 a.m. With no real leads, on February 12th, detectives held an assembly at Thornton asking anyone to come forward with any information. And although some tips trickled in, detectives were still stuck at square one. So when Ashley's funeral was held the next day, lead detectives discreetly attended in the hopes someone might come forward with more information. When no other tips really came in, though, detectives were back at a standstill for several days. However, lab results did come back eventually, suggesting the blood found at the Sanborns was quote-unquote not of human origin, and the other items tested came back inconclusive. A month after the murder, detectives also announced they were still not able to place Ashley alive outside of the Sanborn home. But they announced a $10,000 reward would be given to anyone who could provide vital information regarding Ashley's murder. The evening news also repeated what the police stated at the press conference around the area. And reports state that during the March 1999 press conference, it was broadcasted around the area, and a family located an hour away from Saco in Denmark, Maine, named the Torres family, was watching. When, according to a report, the third child of the family, Tony Torres, age 21, who was on spring break visiting from Farmington College, exclaimed to the family that he knew who killed Ashley. In response, Tony's father told Tony that if he knew something about the case, he should either speak up or keep it to himself. It's unclear what Tony did after the conversation, but from all accounts, things carried on as normal in the Torres household. And then Tony returned to campus after the break was over to finish up his junior year in college. But who exactly was Tony Torres, though? Well, let's take a brief look at his early life. Reports state Angel Antonio, nicknamed Tony, Torres, was born on April 1, 1978, to Narciso and Ramona Torres, their third child. His family was of Puerto Rican descent and primarily lived in New York City, until the crime became too much for them. And Narciso and Ramona packed up their family and moved 5.5 hours away to Denmark, Maine in 1985. It's unclear why they wanted to move specifically to Denmark, but what they did know was that here, crime was pretty much unheard of, and they could afford to give their children a comfortable life here. And just a few years after they moved, they welcomed their fourth son into the family. Reports state that growing up, Tony was very social and popular in school in New York and Maine. He was also very well-rounded and played music and sports, and he also loved to dance. He also made lots of friends outside of school, especially in the Denmark and Saco areas of town. As he studied at school during his early years from elementary through high school, he maintained good grades, so much so that when it was time to think about college, he received several offers from colleges in the New England area. Tony ultimately accepted an offer from Framingham State College, located in Framingham, Massachusetts, where he majored in business and minored in psychology and Spanish. Although he loved being on campus, Tony made a point to visit his family at least twice a month because he was still very family-oriented. And back on campus, Tony was still very popular and even made many friends off campus. He was also very popular with the ladies around town and at school. But he eventually settled down and began a relationship with a fellow student named Beth in late 1998. After Tony returned to school from spring break and eventually completed his junior year of college in May 1999, he got a job as a server during the summer months. Also during his summer break, on May 19th, 1999, Tony called his parents to wish them a happy anniversary, and he told them he had some exciting news, that he and Beth had just got an off-campus apartment nearby in Barre, Massachusetts. Reports state that Tony's mother, Ramona, was happy that Tony's life was continuing to prosper and couldn't wait for her and Narciso to speak with him again. However, a week had passed since their last phone call with Tony, and Ramona started to get concerned. But she was relieved when she received a phone call on May 26th. However, the caller wasn't Tony, it was Beth, and she asked Ramona if she had seen Tony, because she got a call from his job and they said Tony didn't show up for his shift. Ramona told her she hadn't heard from him either recently, and that the last time she saw him physically was when he came to visit Denmark for Mother's Day, and that she and Narciso hadn't made any plans for him to come home to visit. However, Beth said that Tony told her he did have plans in Maine, and she dropped him off at a bus station back on the 19th, the day of the Torres' anniversary. After Beth told her this, Ramona tried not to get too worried, because after all, she knew Tony visited Maine often to see some friends as well, and maybe he just got caught up and forgot to call or visit them on his last trip. But after a day or so, and realizing it was odd that Beth had to call and ask where Tony was, and that he missed a shift at his job, they decided to file a missing persons report. Reports state Tony's family reported him missing from the nearby Bedford, Maine, because Tony was known to hang around there a lot, but they also mentioned he may have been seen in Denmark, Saco, and/or Old Orchard Beach areas. Police got to work almost immediately trying to find Tony, but they could not find any trace of him immediately. However, the police and Tony's family received numerous tips from people who knew and knew about Tony, and many of their stories matched. Reports state some people said they saw Tony attend a party held at his ex-girlfriend's home in Bedford, Maine, and also in attendance there that night was Jay Carney, the boy who was said to have given Ashley Ouellette a ride back on that fateful February 10th night. Witnesses said that sometime during the party, Tony and Jay left around 2 a.m. and went to go to a store together. They then said that after a little while, Jay returned without Tony, and he looked disheveled, with wet, muddy clothes, and he looked very upset. Tony's ex-girlfriend also told police when she asked Jay where Tony was, she said he told her that they walked to a nearby store and that Tony got into a red pickup truck and left for New Hampshire. When she told him that that didn't seem right, she said his temper started to flare and she backed off. However, another report states Jay told witnesses that he went to the store alone and saw Tony there, and he asked for a ride to New Hampshire or to his parents' home, but that he ended up getting a ride with a man in a red truck. When police brought this information to the Torres family, they didn't believe it because they knew Tony would not have come home in the middle of the night or asked a possible random man for a ride. However, after reporting to their parents, police received a few more possibly credible tips about Tony that matched as well, saying he was in town to possibly sell drugs. Reports state that a few more people came forward who lived in Biddeford, Old Orchard Beach, Saco, and Denmark, and they said they witnessed Tony and Jay trying to sell drugs, and that they believed there was a possible drug deal that went bad, and Jay made it out alive, and Tony didn't. Police thought it could be possible, and reluctantly, his parents did as well. Not because Tony was a drug dealer, but that he was naive and may have tried to get a little extra money. But Tony's parents also told police that back in March, when the news report came in about tips for Ashley's murder, Tony told them he knew who did it, and they wondered if this had anything to do with his disappearance. Did he know too much? Did he try and snitch? But his parents state Tony never gave them a name about who possibly killed Ashley. Police wondered about this theory as well, especially since they knew Jay's name was involved in Ashley's investigation, and that they could never verify Jay's story of Tony getting a ride from a man in a truck. However, police were never able to officially tie Jay to Tony's disappearance or Ashley's murder, and he was pretty evasive when questioned. As time went on, despite interviewing multiple witnesses and trying to trace in leads, the murder of Ashley Ouellette and disappearance of Tony Torres went and has remained cold. And in 2004, the Torres family had Tony legally declared dead, but have stated publicly that they hope his body is found and that they have answers one day about what happened to their son. But despite the reward for information regarding both cases increasing, no new leads have been provided as of 2024. Other notes to add, despite cooperating with police early on in the investigation, the Sanborn family has completely stopped complying with police and has never spoken publicly about the case. And Jason J. Carney, a strong person of interest in both cases, died of a drug overdose in June 2015. And as of 2025, both cases remain open and unsolved. The story of the murder of Ashley Ouellette and the disappearance of Angel Tony Torres comes from the sources of the Sun Journal, the Portland Press Herald, News Central Maine, and others I'll put in the notes. All right, that story was a very weird one, and I'm going to give a very short opinion piece on what I think happened. I can't blame anyone, obviously, because no one's been brought to trial, and a main suspect, possible suspect, is deceased. So I can't. Everything's alleged because I wasn't there. I just have my own thoughts about this case. First, rest in peace to Ashley. She didn't deserve this. Whoever did this to her, obviously she was murdered because she was strangled. And whoever did this to her needs to be brought to justice. But I would not be surprised if, I say a big if, the deceased suspect, possible suspect, had something to do with both cases. I can't say if Tony was murdered. It makes sense that he'd be murdered because he hasn't been found. And he's been declared legally dead. He could have gotten into an accident and, you know, maybe died, had an accident, maybe got into some body of water and drowned. We don't know. But all signs are pointing to murder. I don't know if he did actually. I don't know if that drug dealing theory would really pan out. The cops, well, the detectives be formal. The detectives said they believe he did possibly sell some drugs and maybe had a bad, you know, drug deal. However, they also said after he said that he possibly knew who killed Ashley, he could have gotten in trouble for that and been silenced. It has been reported and well documented that he was friends or hung out with Jay Carney. Jay Carney also hung out with Ashley Ouellette and the Sanborn brothers. And Ashley was last seen at the Sanborn brothers' home. And I, like I said, no one knows what happened between the time she was last seen at the home and between the time she was found on the road, except the killer or killers. I would not put it past, I don't know. I can't blame anyone, like I said, but I have a theory that something happened at the home. I don't know if she maybe, I mean, like the phone call, she apparently annoyed Stephen and he wanted to sleep. He didn't want to talk to her. She made her way into the home anyway. And who knows what happened? It's just weird. It's very weird. She wanted to get back with Stephen. Apparently he didn't. I don't think she dated Daniel, but she was closer in age to Daniel and they were apparently friends at Thornton and she just happened to date his older brother. And there's sexual activity that was proven with the open condom wrapper, and reports state other sexual activity had occurred according to a lab analysis, but it didn't really say what happened. So I just think there's so many characters that could have done this to Ashley. And there are so many characters who could have made Tony disappear. They wanted to keep his mouth shut about what he knew about Ashley's murder. That he possibly knew about Ashley's murder. He could have been joking around, said, "I know who did it. You know, ha ha. You know, I know who did it," and may not have known who did this to Ashley. But all signs are pointing that he may have known who did this to Ashley. He hung around them, knew who they were, and they possibly wanted him to be quiet because they didn't want to be brought to justice. Or, like I said, it could have been just a bad drug deal. Even though he didn't have a history of dealing drugs, he may have just wanted some extra money and just dabbled in it a little bit and it went bad. But like I said, I hope that the families, both families, get justice and that the killer of Ashley gets brought to justice. And however Tony died or however he's found, answers could be found. And that's it. Thank you for tuning in to the season 6 premiere of 90s Crime Time. If this episode piqued your interest and you haven't done so already, please leave a review and rating if your podcast platform has a rating system. Also, as of right now, I'm trying to release new episodes weekly, but if things change, I will let you know in advance. Also, again, look out for 90s stories I have written on medium.com, and I'll put the link in the show notes again. And I'm trying to have a new story released by the end of this week. So look out for that, as well as looking out for posts on Instagram, primarily on the weekends, including this weekend, and with one released later tonight. So look out for that, 90s Crime Time on Instagram. Stay safe and healthy, and I'll see you soon for a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time.